بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله والصلاة والسلام على الأمين محمد، وأشهد أن لا إله إلا الله وحده لا شريك له، وأشهد أن محمدا عبده ورسوله. أما بعد، so let me welcome you to this class that we're calling Islam and Contemporary Controversies. A very ambitious class, at least from the title it seems. Inshallah. Any questions? This handout, by the way, for those of you on the internet, inshallah, it will be emailed to you sometime in the very near future, but not right now. Inshallah, because the flash drive is not here. Inshallah, so this handout, like usual, just gives you some general information about the class. As you see there under required textbook, I put, unfortunately, none, and that is because I'm not real satisfied with any of the books related to some of the topics that we'll be covering. At least not the first one that we'll be covering, inshallah. So, inshallah, in this session, inshallah, as you see under basic outline of the class, this session is going to be mostly about human rights and Islam. So there are actually many, many, many books written about human rights and Islam. Some of them much better than others, but none that will follow consistently what we'll be covering. So what I did under basic outline of class, well, under recommended textbooks, I gave you the name of three books. And then below, under basic outline of the class, also gave you some of the readings from each of those books. This is one of the books. It's called International Human Rights and Islamic Law by Masood Bedrin. It's this is actually his PhD dissertation from Oxford University. Again, it's not going to be covering, or does not cover exactly what we'll be covering in the class. A lot of the topics we'll be touching on, he does not cover, and that is basically the case with all of the books that are available. The goal, inshallah, if we complete this session and also move on, is to cover a number of topics that are relevant and are what we can call of a controversial nature nowadays, including clash of civilizations, Islam and globalization, extremism, terrorism, jihad, modernism and progressive Islam, feminism and Islam, Islam in the media, also democracy. The supposed to be on the backside of the sheet, but it didn't come out. Democracy and Islam, and also secularism and Islam. These are all the kinds of topics that we hope to cover, inshallah, in these sessions. These different sessions, not all this session, as I said. This session will be mostly about related to human rights. And we'll have, like we have in the other classes, we'll have a final exam. Okay, notice there's no pop quiz. There's not even mention of it, which makes it even better. That way, if I decide to have one, it'll be really a surprise. I don't think it'll happen. However, in this class, you'll have an option. Instead of a final exam, you can do a 5-page paper summarizing, or not summarizing, but analyzing two articles on human rights in Islam, or one book about human rights in Islam. If you don't like exams, you can kind of control what you do if you do the paper instead. Yeah, I guess you could do that. You could do both and whichever you do. No, you choose the articles. But I mean, you know, make sure they're good articles. So, yes. The other two books, one of them, I'm sorry. The other two books, one is called Human Rights in Islam, the Divine and Mundane and Human Rights Law. I don't know how to pronounce his last name. There's too many vowels in there for me to to handle that. Yeah. Pardon me?
Online just gonna start now.
What do you mean online just gonna start now? I heard they were already... there's been a lot of technical difficulties today, hopefully, inshallah. Won't happen again. So I'm going to have to start all over. Any questions while we're waiting? So yes, the Human Rights in Islam, the one by that person with all the vowels in his name. This is basically, you know, it's basically taking the text from the Quran and Sunnah, and basically identifying what rights can be based on them. And there's a little bit of cross-cultural analysis in there. It's published by iUniverse, which is a self-publishing company. So there are some typos and stuff in there, as you would see in a work of that nature. The other book, Islamic Jurisprudence and International Perspective, this is actually written by a non-Muslim, Christopher Weeramantri from Sri Lanka, if I remember correctly. And that one is more of a theoretical. The only actually part that I referred to it is, or I didn't refer to it here, it's more of giving kind of like the foundation of what is human rights in Islam, not really covering different human rights. And actually in today's lecture, inshallah, if we get to it, we're going to actually kind of be covering what is the different literature available and where they come from, so to speak.
Do you have any plan to write any book?
Yes, I do have a plan to write it, and in fact, I've already missed the deadline, unfortunately. So I don't know if this class will make me be even later, or it'll help me finish it, inshallah. Pardon me? I hope so, inshallah. That's why it says Allah willing, right? Inshallah. Inshallah. There'll be maybe some articles about very specific aspects. Maybe. Not very long. Inshallah. There will be actually later in the class, inshallah, when we do the law of apostasy in Islam, and when we do the cartoon controversy, and also I've added the obsession. How many of you heard about this obsession? So inshallah, we'll also be touching on that. So those two, I have articles on both of those two. And hopefully I'll be posting them, inshallah. So we can assume that you're going to get it fixed or not. Question while we're waiting. Oh, by the way, I put freedom of religion. I didn't mean to put freedom of religion. I meant to put freedom of speech. So it is the why we're discussing it in particular is that it is related to the issue of freedom of speech. So, yes, satanic versus anything probably could be under the general. And then if you have something specific you wanted to bring up, we could. First, basically we'll be dealing with the principles more than necessarily the specific examples. But the specific examples help, in particular, let's say, the reaction to the specific examples. For example, one thing that we hope to discuss in some detail, inshallah, which is under topic five, is the European headscarf debate. And we're going to discuss, inshallah, how the European courts justified banning the headscarf and justified the laws saying that Muslims could not wear the headscarf under different circumstances. Yeah. And the reason we'll be doing that is because when we see the reasoning is approved by, and by the way, Europe is considered the leading experts on human rights, the leading proponents, even much beyond the United States. So when we analyze how Islam, for example, is considered as violating human rights and with some of its laws, we'll see that actually when they need to, they will actually invoke some of the same. So the way I'm doing it here, and I'm sure a lot of people won't be happy with this. So usul al-fiqh is one of the essential fields. Usul al-fiqh is, how would you translate usul al-fiqh into English? Okay, principles of Islamic jurisprudence is one of the common Islamic legal theory. I like Islamic legal theory because it's mostly theory, not many people really apply it. that's a little joke. Okay, Islamic legal theory. What does Islamic legal theory tell us? What's that all about? Okay, explains to us what is and is not a source of Islamic law. In other words, what is an authority? Or what they call a hujjah. What is an authority? What is it that we have to submit to and listen to? And what else does it tell us? What else does it show us? Okay, it also gives us the methodology from which we go to the text and we derive rulings from the text. So Islamic legal theory covers both. Identifies the sources, what is an authority, and then it also shows us how do we use those authorities. How do we derive laws from those authorities? What else? One big one that no one has mentioned yet.
By the way, would Sharia be included in the fiqh also, or is that a separate? Would that be considered separate?
Sharia?
Yes.
What is Sharia?
I mean, it would be, since it's jurisprudence, and this was also translated as jurisprudence, I was wondering if it's considered to be one and the same thing. Or
You know, Sharia depends on how you define it, but Sharia is basically the text of the Quran. So that is the Sharia. The actual text of the Quran. Arabic language. Okay. Arabic language also essential. Why, do you think? What was that? Because the Quran is in the Arabic language. So you cannot, although I have seen this before, you cannot make tafsir of the Quran based on the principles of Urdu. Even though I have seen it done, it doesn't work. Okay. It has to be the Arabic language. Okay, so those are the fundamental sciences. And these are the ones that if someone is really interested in understanding Islam, these are really the sciences that they should pay a great deal of attention to. Because from this basically flows everything else. So for example, from these we get what we could call the basic and classic fiqh. The basic and classic fiqh. The laws, how to apply Quran and Sunnah, basic classic fiqh. What I mean by basic classic fiqh are these are the issues that have been discussed by ulama throughout the centuries. Basically, most of the discussion concerning them has been done. It is just really a matter of going to what they said and trying to figure out who has the strongest arguments and so forth. And so that would cover all of the ritual acts of worship, like tahara and prayer and fasting and so forth. It would also cover laws of marriage and divorce and business. And also from those essential studies, we also have contemporary fiqh issues. Contemporary fiqh issues are not those that are directly touched on by the Quran and Sunnah, but the relevant evidence, the relevant principles to deal with them are already captured in the Quran and Sunnah. So it's just a matter of going to those principles and figuring out how do they apply to these new kind of situations. Like for example, issues related to if an individual is on the life support system, organ transplant. Some of the issues may be related to abortion, for example. Contemporary business transactions. These are all, they're not captured in the basic classic fiqh works. They were not discussed by the ulama before. But the principles are kind of all there. It's just a matter of taking those principles and extending them a little bit. And then we get these things over here, which I'm calling contemporary controversies. So these are a kind of a different category. They're different from the other two categories in a number of ways. Number one, they're not simply fiqh related, because many of these what I'm referring to as contemporary controversies, many of them touch upon aqidah, and their long range implications with respect to practice can be very great indeed. So, for example, secularism, or even this question of human rights. Many times also, these kind of issues are being forced upon us nowadays because the Muslim Ummah, the state of the Muslim Ummah, Islam is not the dominant paradigm nowadays, right? Islam is not the dominant paradigm. What is the dominant paradigm? What would you call it? Secularism or
secular humanism,
okay. Western civilization, if you want to even maybe make it even broader. So there's certain concepts that this dominant paradigm has, right? And we as Muslims then are forced to deal with these concepts. Not just because necessarily they're being forced upon us, but even from within the Muslim Ummah, there are people who are seeing that this is the dominant paradigm and are being influenced and affected, and maybe even are these things have some appeal to them. Like democracy, for example, or even secularism, or human rights, like what we're going to be discussing. And unfortunately, many of these kinds of topics have not been dealt with by our ulama in the way and in the depth that they need to be discussed. Because one of the principles that many of the scholars mention is that you cannot analyze anything unless you have the proper perception of it. Right? For example, if I were to ask you, is organ transplants halal or haram? What would you say?
I don't know when I forgot it.
Good. Okay, good answers. What's that? He's mashallah. He doesn't even care. He's not going to say, I don't know. It just depends on the situation. But you have to have an idea, what is the organ transplant, right? How does it work? What is it? What is it involved? Because there's different kinds of transplants. You can transplant something from one part of your body to another part. You can transplant from animals to humans. You can transplant from live human beings to live human beings. You can transplant from dead humans to live humans. So unless you know what is going on and all the ramifications of those different types of transplants, and even what is the effect of them, there is something, I forget what they call it, I think they call it cell memory, where individuals have had heart transplants, and let's say like they got a heart from a Pakistani, and so that Pakistani who he got the heart from likes spices. This individual never before liked spices. All of a sudden he gets this heart and he has a taste and a liking for spices. This has actually occurred. Or occurs, as I said, I believe they call it cell memory. Does this affect the overall ruling of heart transplants or something? Getting a heart from a kafir? Who knows what that might do to you? Okay, so all of these things, you know, unless you have a good conceptualization of it, alhamdulillah, we have many, many Muslim doctors. Right? So we have no shortage of people among our ummah who understand these things very well. But even if they understand them very well, unless they have those foundational sciences, they also cannot make really any judgment about it. But at least, alhamdulillah, we have many who understand them. What about issues like democracy and secularism and human rights? These kind of issues, many of our ulama, many of them, not all of course, but many of them, they never even studied them, have no clue really what they're about. But they're very popular nowadays, right? You hear about human rights, you hear about all these topics. Because of the dominant paradigm. And what occurs often, and what has occurred, especially in the English literature, is that these kinds of topics, especially these last kinds of topics, are left for people to discuss, and these people, unfortunately, are not very strong when it comes to the foundational sciences. So what do you think is going to happen with respect to their conclusions? Okay, so it's going to be very easy for them to come to conclusions that maybe even contradict really the basic ideas of Islam. And this is a big problem that we're facing nowadays. We have lots of issues, and very few of our ulama have taken the time to study them properly and in such depth that they can make real judgments concerning them. And unfortunately, if you do not make that in-depth kind of study, the judgment that you make may be based on a partial understanding, and that judgment could maybe cause more harm than good. So this is kind of my ideas of why even bringing up these kind of topics and why studying them is because of this phenomena that we are facing now. And these are, by the way, especially for our youth in the West, right? These are topics that they're going to have to deal with, or these are topics that they are interested in. And they have to know, or they want to know, what is the Islamic perspective on all of these topics. Where they want to turn to get an answer. Yes?
Are you going to cover issues where different scholars who are in the East have made rulings and they may not apply directly or may not apply the same way in the West? For example, I have, you know, without clear understanding of the exact situation of the way interest and loan works in the U.S., there have been rulings which have been interpreted as, you know, to make an Islamic, or to establish yourself in the West, it is acceptable. And the ruling was made that you can deal in interest in property and things like that.
And this particular class, especially probably in this particular session, that particular example probably we won't be dealing with.
Maybe some things
of that nature. Maybe. But that maybe is a slightly different. That maybe even goes back maybe more towards this kind of contemporary fiqh issues, as opposed to these more general concepts that people are dealing with nowadays. Well, this is not just how we deal with other societies, because this also has a lot of ramifications for our own societies and how we deal with one another. You know, for example, what is a human right? What are the human rights from an Islamic perspective? What does it mean from an Islamic perspective to say this is a human right? This is something even internal for an Islamic society is very important. Also, democracy. Also, we're talking about how to run a state. What is the Islamic view of democracy or secularism or all of these other issues? So they're not just how we deal with the outside world, but the problem is, since these are part of the dominant paradigm nowadays, whether we like it or not, we as Muslims are being influenced by these concepts. And we have to recognize what is the influence for example, nowadays, you can find Muslims who, let's say like the question of homosexuality. You can find Muslims who say, you know, how can we object to homosexuality? This is a human right. I mean, especially here in this country, you can find a lot of Muslims who say that. So that's why he's saying the word human right. Maybe he doesn't even know where this came from, what is the history of it, what is it all about. And most likely he doesn't know how to deal with it from Islamic perspective, that's that's for sure. So the first thing I want to start out is basically, and I have a reason for this, I'm going to start out by stating what are my biases with respect to what are the essential sciences and what do they imply. Because nowadays, one of the main arguments that you can find in numerous books written by non-Muslims about Islam, as well as written by a number of Muslims about Islam and these kind of contemporary issues, is that they make the argument that Islam is not what they call a monolith. I don't know how many, actually I noted in my notes, no need to dig through that right now, but I cannot remember right now how many books in which the author starts out by making this point. What does that mean? What does the word monolith mean? What's that? Mono means one, right? Huh? It means rock. That is true. That's not what they mean. Well, I mean, it's related to that. So you're talking about one big rock or one type of rock, right? So what they mean by this is that Islam is not really one united entity. And so they go from that to say that in reality there are many, many types or brands of Islam. Do you have a problem with that? Who would agree with that, that there are many types of Islam? Okay. Who here in this room would be willing to admit that he agrees? All right. You agree with that there are many Islams?
There are many interpretations of Islam.
Many interpretations of Islam. Okay. So when you talk about Muslims, for example, you can find many varieties of Muslim, right? Okay, so there are many interpretations of Islam. So if you are, for example, a human rights advocate, an activist, working at the United Nations, coming up with some laws which are going to become international law, and you start with this argument that, look, there are many interpretations of Islam. What do you think they can conclude then from that? That there are many interpretations of Islam. How do you think they use this argument?
Find an interpretation which matches their intended laws.
Okay. The first thing they do, even that's going to be where they end up with, but before they even get to that, they'll say, for example, that the fundamentalists or traditional interpretation of Islam, this is not necessarily an Islam that we need to view as being correct or as being predominant among the Muslims, or that we necessarily have to respect. It's interesting to see how non-Muslims write about Islam. I mean, they're making bigger fatwas than any Muslim scholar would make, you know, about what is acceptable, what isn't acceptable in Islam. So their argument is that since Muslims vary, then we can identify a brand of Islam that works with our laws and so forth. And as long as there's some brand of Islam that works, then we don't have to worry about those extremists, those fundamentalists, who may not be happy with what we conclude. By the way, from a human rights perspective, and by the way, in this class, this topic, right, this one of the differences between this topic here and this topic over here, as I said, this topic has been all kind of researched you know, there's very little room for discussion. So this would be like the Fiqh Sunnah class. I'm not going to be, not going to give you guys too much opportunity to come up with strange ideas. But over here, this here is in a real, a real state of flux. Right? So feel free to state what you think. So in this case, you know, what I mean by that is that, inshallah, when you state what you think, I'm not going to be able to say, oh, look, you're directly contradicting the Quran, Sunnah, get out of my class. But think about human rights now. And think about the fact that they are saying that yes, we realize that there are some Muslims who, for example, we're going to call them fundamentalists, traditional. We realize that those Muslims exist, but we are not going to worry about them when we make our final laws, because we have found other Muslims who agree with us. From a human rights perspective, does that make any sense? Think about what they're trying to do. Yes?
Consequently, they're marginalizing the majority of Muslims, or the traditional, and that seems to be misrepresenting what Islam says, which is defamatory in a way.
Okay, they are saying, look, and they, by the way, they'll probably say they're not the majority, they'll probably say it's just some little percentage of it, but they are saying, look, we know that these Muslims exist. We don't really care what is the foundation for what they're saying, you know. That doesn't matter to them. Because, by the way, most of these, or a lot of these people, contemporary people, they are what you call like postmodernist or things like this. They don't have much respect for religion anyway. They don't really think it's revelation and all that. They think it's more cultural and sociological and historical and all this kind of thing. But they are identifying this Islam, and they are saying that basically we don't have to show respect. Basically, that's what they're saying. We don't have to show respect for this Islam. But suppose you are a fundamentalist Muslim, what they would call a fundamentalist Muslim, which is another topic, fundamentalism. But suppose you are proud to be a fundamentalist Muslim, okay? Like you guys from Boulder. If you are a fundamentalist Muslim, what now is going to happen to your human rights to practice your religion freely if they can make some claim like this? I mean, even the very foundation, what they're doing itself is kind of contradicting some of their own premises about what human rights is. Because human rights should allow you to choose freely what kind of Islam you want to follow. But we'll find that, in fact, that is not the case. There is a fundamental flaw. So I'm beginning the lectures by pointing out this fundamental flaw in the whole theory of human rights. And then we'll go through this whole long passage, and then we'll come back to the fact that there is a fundamental flaw. And if there's a fundamental flaw, then the question then is going to be, well, why should we as Muslims submit to this theory that we know is fundamentally flawed? But that's a long that's a long ways away. Yes?
Maybe my question would be long, but the same way for society of Muslims, because in the same case, if you say, well, a monolith, you're going to take anything that any Muslim does and say that represents an empire. I mean, it's, they're going to criticize us either way, even if they were a monolith or not a monolith, right?
Okay, my argument, or what I'm saying, is that it is irrelevant whether we are a monolith or not. Right? You cannot use this as an argument to say, oh, we're going to find some Islam that is compatible with us. Okay. That's irrelevant, because you still have all those Muslims, or that version of Islam, that is not compatible with what you do. What are you going to do about that? You know, just because you're making some Muslims happy doesn't mean you have the right to make other Muslims not happy. So it is irrelevant. The question of whether or not Islam or Muslims is a monolith is completely irrelevant. But they are using it. As I said, there's at least, like for example, the most recent book that came out on Islam and human rights by Irene Oh, and Elizabeth Ann Meyer, and Donnelly. All of these are basic human rights works. All of them, on the first few pages, they start out saying Islam is not a monolith, and they are using that then from, but it is completely, it's an argument that is completely irrelevant. But they have a, I mean, it's irrelevant in one sense, but it's very useful to them in another sense. It should be irrelevant. Was that?
Yeah, that's
which is basically, I mean, that's one of the groups that they're going to say, well, see, we got this group. And that's also another topic in this, you know, modernism and Islam and progressive Islam, important topic, especially with respect to the United States and the Muslims in the United States. Okay, so, and it's interesting, by the way, in one of one book, there's an author, her name is Anne Elizabeth Meyer. Has anyone read her book, Islam and Human Rights? It has just entered its fourth edition. And this is one of the basic or most important writings on Islam and human rights available in English. It's not a recommended textbook. In fact, we're going to critique it. So that's why you don't see it as a recommended textbook. But for example, so here is I just want to, you know, give you an example of how far these human rights proponents, she's a human rights lawyer and stuff, and so just to give you some example of how far these human rights proponents will go in trying to picture another Islam. In her work, she praises very highly two groups in the history of Islam. If you think of all the groups in the history of Islam, what two groups do you think a human rights activist, what two groups do you think a human rights, this is a difficult, this would be a good exam question. Why am I should have said this. So, of all the groups, and we've had plenty of groups in Islam, right? because we're not a monolith. of all the groups in Islam, who do you think a human rights activist would praise as, here's examples of Muslims in the history that the contemporary Muslims should learn from? One of them, maybe, is not that surprising. The other one is a little bit more surprising. Yes, they do like extreme Sunni groups, this is not who she was highlighting in. But they do. There's a number of writers that they quote that are, you know, extreme Sufi, and they like what they say. Tablighi Jama'ah? No. Tablighi Jama'ah is too traditional, too conservative. Now, okay, the Mu'tazila. Who are the Mu'tazila? What do they usually refer to them as? The rationalists of Islam. The rationalists. I find this one, now as I said, this one is not going to be that shocking. Okay? Because they're rationalists. Right? They want us Muslims to be rationalists. So, because when you're rationalist, you can kind of ignore the Quran and Sunnah if your mind tells you something else. Right? But if you're familiar with the history of the Mu'tazila and some of their basic principles, which includes, by the way, revolution. Revolution is a basic principle to the Mu'tazila. But if you're familiar with their history, one of the few times that the Mu'tazila actually had power, what did they do with their power? They tried to insist. One of the things that there was part of their beliefs was the fact that the Quran was created. It is not the speech of Allah, the uncreated speech of Allah, but they say it is created. And they tried to enforce upon all of the ulama that they would accept the fact that the Quran was created. And under that pressure, many of the ulama said, yes, sure, why not? Among those who did not, for example, was Ahmed ibn Hanbal. Ahmed ibn Hanbal was sent to prison, was punished, was tortured, because he would not agree with their beliefs about the creation of the Quran. This is the Mu'tazila. This is one of the few times in the history of Islam that they had authority. And this is one of the groups that she's praising as someone we should take an example from in our history. The other group, yes, you have a...
Uh-huh. The ones who studied Greek philosophy, are they
Mu'tazila would be, okay. Yes. But also you have philosophers, which is slightly different group.
Would that be like the Ibn Rushd?
Ibn Rushd and Ibn Sina are more philosophers.
Okay.
Ibn Rushd is kind of, I don't want to say schizophrenic, but I mean there's some of his writings is very much Ahlul Sunnah, and in other things he's very much into philosophy and stuff like that. The other group that she mentioned, who do you think? Yes.
Sufis.
Oh, are they back on?
Modernists.
No, so okay, Sufis already been mentioned. Modernists already, or no, this is in our history.
Shia.
No, not the Shia. What is known as the most violent group in the history of Islam? The Khawarij. She praises the Khawarij. Yeah, because they believed everyone was equal and democracy and all that stuff. These are the ones that we are supposed to be taking examples from. This is a human rights lawyer, a human rights proponent who doesn't care too much actually for traditional Islam and so forth. One of the aspects of the Khawarij, is that they believe that everyone was equal. It doesn't matter if you're a slave or what, everyone is equal. And in some of their groups, also they accepted also women as being equal, in the sense that the contemporary. So because of that, she says we should look to them. So the question, first and foremost, as I said, we have to define, at least for ourselves, we don't have to worry too much about the non-Muslims. We have to first define what is Islam and what are the parameters of Islam. I'm not going to speak about that because I'm going to assume that you all know that. Is that a good assumption? Inshallah. Looking around, I would say it's a good assumption. I am happy with that assumption. Inshallah. I mean the basic aspects of what is Islam, I think you know, inshallah. We have her name is Anne Elizabeth Meyer. Or Meyer, if you're German. Anne Elizabeth Meyer, Islam and Human Rights. So we cannot get to a situation, and this is what frustrates me a lot when I read Western scholarly works, quote-unquote scholarly works on Islam. What frustrates me the most is that they lose all kind of scholarly conditions when they're in. So for example, and this is all kind of introduction to get us into seeing what kind of things were up against and what kind of things are being written about Islam. I was hoping also to cover the different kinds of writings, but inshallah we'll do that next time, inshallah. But I want to give you, first of all, could it be possible that any religion would accept the fact that just because I am a Muslim, for example, that simply because I am a Muslim, that means I can understand Islam? What about simply because I am a male Muslim? That must mean I can understand Islam. What about if I were a female Muslim? Should that give me some special insight into what Islam is? You sure? Nowadays, I think it's easier to argue that as a female, I'll... Okay. So let me just, I'm going to read to you part of a passage. This was written by an Algerian woman. It was a set of articles. The name of the book is called Religious Fundamentalisms and the Human Rights of Women. The author's name is Mahnes Afkhami, if you want to Google her for some reason and see what other gems she has out there. I'll give you her name. And unfortunately, you know, non-Muslims, when they read about Islam, they turn to these kinds of books. Our own Muslims in school, because this is, by the way, this book has been used, and by the way, Anne Elizabeth Meyer, the book I referred to earlier, this is one of the basic textbooks used throughout the colleges in the United States on the in the classes on Islam. And this book I'm referring to here is also a basic textbook in many of the classes on women's human rights. So this woman has an interesting passage. She said, the central point in women's human rights is simple. The Islamists always posit the question of women's rights within an Islamic frame of reference. Okay, so what is she saying? Is that positive or negative? She said, the Islamists, you know, you extremists, you fundamentalists, the Islamists always posit the question of women's rights within an Islamist frame of reference. Would that be a good, is that positive or negative?
Positive.
Huh? Okay, but here, this is like, you know, if you know who her audience is, this is about as negative a statement as you can get. And it goes against what we were just saying, right? Because I was making the whole argument that as Muslims, we should put it within this frame of reference. So she says, that frame of reference determines the boundaries of my existence as a Muslim woman. Okay. So far, so good. Again, if you're reading it as something positive, you are misunderstanding what she's saying. The questions I ask are, why should I, as a mature Muslim woman, not have the right to determine how to organize my personal life? What gives another person the right to interfere in my personal life? Okay. You know, the abortion debate here, you always see those women holding those posters, you know, it's my body, keep your hands off my body, no one can pass any laws over my body. So why is it that a Muslim cleric arrogates to himself the right to place me forcibly in a preordained framework? So it is possible, by the way, that a Muslim cleric, Muslim scholar, could write things about Muslim women that is incorrect, right? And especially when we talk about the situation of women, Muslim women and human rights later. I mean, this is an issue, has two aspects to it. One aspect is what is really going on within the Muslim societies. And there's no question that there's a lot of problems there with respect to women's rights. The other aspect is then going to an extreme beyond what is the correct view. So after saying, you know, what gives him the right to do that? Does he derive his authority from God? Does he derive it from the text? Does he derive it from tradition? Suppose he derived it from God. Would that be a good argument? Somehow he derived it from God. Suppose he derived it from the text. Would that be good? Okay, if he derived it from tradition, how about that? That may be acceptable or not. Depends on what that tradition is. Even Muslims have anti or non-Islamic traditions. But suppose he derived it from God or like from the Quran or from text. Should that be unacceptable for a Muslim woman or Muslim man for that matter? Okay. So then she says, I reject all of these claims for his authority. I argue that as a Muslim woman, I know in principle, as well as any man, what God ordains or what the text says. Okay, so it's not a matter of going to those sciences and understanding those sciences, but I as a Muslim woman, or I as a Muslim man, just because I'm Muslim, this gives me the right to understand and to say what God ordains or what the text really says. Okay, then she goes on with what her interpretation of Islam should be. So her basic argument there is basically that anyone Muslim, whether it's a male or female actually, anyone Muslim should be able to say for themselves, well, you know, I'm a Muslim, so therefore I can define myself as a Muslim in any way I want. I can say what God wants from me. I can say what the texts say. Could any religion really exist and continue if it were open to something of this nature? Now the question is, and this is what you get, sometimes in logic you get invalid questions. The question that we should ask, or that we would ask, or maybe I'm assuming that we would ask, is what is her proof for what she's saying? Right? Can she prove it from the Quran and Sunnah that she has that right? But this is an invalid question, because you are starting from assumptions that she is not starting from. She's starting from the assumption that as a human being, simply as a human being, she has the right to interpret the text any way that she feels is correct. That's it. She knows. She knows as a human being. She knows what God wants from her. Now, is this a very scholarly passage? And by the way, this is she wrote two articles in that book, and she was the Muslim representative in that book. Right, all of these books about fundamentalism and religion, they always have articles about Christianity, about Judaism, and so forth. Usually, Christianity and Judaism, they have Christians and Jews who sometimes are a little bit sympathetic. When it comes to Muslim, this is a typical. Could this be considered a scholarly approach by any means? Scholarly? Postmodernist. It could be scholarly if you're postmodernist.
Anyone who writes a book is a scholar.
Anyone who writes a book is a scholar? How many books have you written? Okay, so yes, do you have a question?
Is it Fatima Mernissi?
No, Fatima Mernissi is a different person. Mahnez Afkhami. She's Algerian. Fatima Mernissi is Moroccan, actually. So next time, inshallah, I'm going to start with discussing, kind of reviewing what are, with respect to the question of human rights in Islam, there are three basic trends in the literature, and we're going to discuss those three and kind of critique them, inshallah. So quickly, Isha, we still have a few minutes before Isha. Any question now? Yes. Okay, some branches of, or some understanding of the Protestant Revolution, or the Protestant Reformation, I guess. Yeah, some understandings of that, you could say, is that every individual is able to interpret the Bible, and so therefore you don't need the church, but. So the problem, yeah, this kind of argument, this kind of thing that she says may resonate with non-Muslims, with especially people of the West. And this is also one of the bigger issues, or one of the problems that we're facing. They don't see or they don't understand why this could not, or probably will not, resonate with the Muslims. And that's one of the points that I'll be making next time, inshallah, when I review some of the literature. This book in which this passage is from is called Religious Fundamentalisms and the Human Rights of Women. It's edited by a woman called Courtney Howland, and I'll be quoting her next time. Not the biggest fan of Islam. Now, this is an article, she's the author of the article, which is a collection of articles, this book. Yeah, I would say that is pretty much the premise that they use. When it comes to religion, obviously religion is not a science, right? Religion has more to do maybe with feelings and stuff like that. So the academic standards for writing something about religion are not very high, you could say. And so this is a scholarly, quote-unquote scholarly work. This woman, I believe she's a professor somewhere. She could include this work as one of her publications to get promoted and so forth, because that's what you have to do as a professor. And but you know, when you actually read and look at it, it's like, how is this considered a scholarly work? But I mean, a lot of what is written about Islam in the West is kind of things of this nature. I mean, probably you all heard about that. What's the name? His name is like Luxembourg or something like that.
Bernard Lewis?
No. Bernard Lewis at least comes up with, you know, at least he does some research and he does some, you know, you may not like some of his conclusions, but at least he does academic work, you know. But, the guy, what's his name, Luxembourg, who came up with the theory that the Quran, the Arabic that we know now was not the Arabic of the Quran and all that nonsense, you know, that Hurlain, for example, means grapes. And you know. I mean, this guy published, and you know, I'm sure he got promoted based on this stuff that he published, and it's just nonsense. You know.
I got a long question.
Well, we don't have time for a long question. About the fact that yes, we're against pornography and all that other stuff. I think she's also the same one, if I'm not mistaken, also who wrote about the funding of the so-called terrorists and whatnot. So sometimes she has some writings which are positive. Sometimes she has some writings which are very negative. So, yeah. Quickly, any sisters have a question? Okay then. Inshallah, we'll break for now, inshallah, and catch the salat, inshallah. Subhanakallah.